Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the SOM TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. On today's pod, I am joined by our managing editor of the SOM TV magazine, Nicole McKay, and we're going to be talking about Canadian wine. I regret to say this is the very first time I think we've had an in-depth conversation about Canadian wine. And to celebrate, we're going to have Canada's most famous son, Jason Priestley, and his partner, Terry David Mulligan, on to talk about their wine Q&A that they make in the Okanagan Valley. Before we do this conversation with the great Jason Priestley, I do want to say, go to somtv.com and subscribe. It is $49.99 for a year, and you can get the best entertainment in the wine and food world. Right now, we have a brand new Behind the Glass episode, which is a documentary covering 7 years of Ross Noel Vineyards construction, from just a plot of land all the way to their second harvest. It was a long time coming, and I really think you guys are going to enjoy this. Nicole, before we bring Jason in, let's talk about Canada as a wine culture. You know, as an American, I've been to Canada many times, but I don't think of wine when I think of Canada. So you being up there right now, talk to me about what wine is like from a culture standpoint in Canada.
Well, I can speak more to British Columbia specifically rather than the whole of the country, because it's a large country.
Yeah, that's true. It is quite large.
Growing up in BC, and you know, I spent some summers in Okanagan, the winemaking culture there is large and the people support it wholeheartedly. It's very much about local economy, local families that are owning vineyards and making wine, and local businesses. So when it comes to what's being made in BC, a lot of it is staying in BC, to be perfectly honest. Even across Canada, distribution across provinces is very minimal. So it's very much British Columbians drinking wines from their own backyards, and they love them. The climate, I mean, there's different pockets of this and that, but you know, northern Okanagan, you're going to get Pinot Noir, light-skinned reds, and aromatic whites. And then down in the south, where it's very warm, you're going to get the heat that's required to ripen those big Bordeaux grapes, like Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc. So it's vast and dynamic, and it's pretty fun. I think if I had to put numbers onto it for context, there's probably just over 10,000 planted acres across the province of BC. And if I'm remembering correctly, that's a fraction of what's in Napa Valley. So it's quite different. It's very vast and dynamic, like I said, diverse. But people up here love their wine.
Would you say the region has an identity yet? I know it's quite new. I mean, we're talking there's been wine in some form there for a while.
Totally.
But as a commercial thing, does it have an identity yet as a region that stands out differently from others?
I don't think so yet. It's working on it. And I think the geography of the Okanagan speaks more to its identity rather than actual expression, if that makes sense. Like, because there's so many different pockets and there's so much adventurous winemaking being done, I don't know if the world winemaking market can pinpoint what exactly is coming from the Okanagan yet.
I do love these places where it's a lot of experimentation. And I say this in a good way, a lot of copying other regions and trying to figure out what they're going to be. I mean, these, you know, people forget wine takes a long time. And it doesn't just take a long time to make wine. It takes a long time to establish what the hell it's going to be and then establish the rules to keep it that way. And I mean, sometimes that's takes hundreds of years, honestly. So it's fascinating. Should we bring
in the baby? It's just a baby market right
now. It's just a baby.
But it's working on it.
That's right. No. And it's wonderful. I mean, there's wine grown all over Canada. We're obviously talking about this one region, which I think is one of the more beautiful regions in the world. Should we bring in Jason and his partner?
Let's do it.
It's interesting to be joined by you two. I'm joined by Jason Priestley, who famously, all I'm aware you've ever done has been in the movie Tombstone. I'm unaware of anything else you've ever done, but I hear you've done other work. and Terry David Mulligan, the two of you guys went into wine. I was going to start this podcast off with, why on God's earth are you on a wine podcast? I think it's a valid question from the outside world, because a lot of people can't find your wine here in the States. And I know people listen to this podcast all over the world, so I don't want to say, but you're, I regret to say, I think you are among the very first Canadian wineries we have had on the SOM TV podcast, which is a big shame on us, considering Nicole McKay, who is on the pod, who is our managing magazine editor, is Canadian. And so I want to apologize to all the Canadians listening. Jason, welcome to the SOM TV podcast. I can say that you finally made it.
Well, thank you, Jason. It's nice to be here and feel like I finally arrived. Yeah, it's you know, well, the Canadian wine industry is for people who don't know about the Canadian wine industry, it is a very vibrant industry. It seems to be based predominantly in southern British Columbia. In southern Ontario, there is an industry out in Nova Scotia as well, and there are some smaller pockets in other provinces as well. But those seem to be the big three. Terry may know of a couple other small ones. He actually lives in Canada. I of course pulled up stakes and moved to America about 35 years ago. But it is a very robust, very thriving industry up there. And we Terry and I started producing wine up in Canada. Back in 2007, me and a group of gentlemen bought a winery in southern British Columbia called the Black Hills Estate. We then sold that winery back in 2019 to a conglomerate out of Ontario called Andrew Peller Estates. And now Terry and I have started this new venture of Q&A Wine with a winemaker again in southern the Okanagan Valley. Michael Mosney, and are very excited to be selling the wine now in BC and Alberta. And you know, soon we'll be exporting some of the wine to America, so our friends in America will be able to access the wine.
I wanted to ask about context about you and Terry and where your friendship formed. I mean, Terry is a broadcaster from Vancouver, so how did you connect with him initially?
Well, wait a minute. We're in the middle of the ocean. We're fishing. I'm out fishing him, so he starts to talk about wine, and he doesn't shut up about wine for 3 days. And eventually, at the end of it, we all of a sudden he had my interest in wine. That's where it all started for me. I did outfish him.
I hope you were drinking during this.
Of course, we were. We had nothing but bottles of wine. I don't remember Terry outfishing me per se, but it's true. This whole thing started. Our adventures in wine together started with us fishing. Where were you, Terry? Hackeye Pass? Yeah, is that where we were? Out on the west coast of Vancouver Island?
And you said to me, do you still get those records at your front door for your radio show? And I said, yeah. He said, imagine if we did a wine show. People would be leaving bottles of wine on your front door. And I went, oh, I like that.
So we came up with an idea, not unlike what you guys are producing on SOM TV. We came up with an idea to do a food and wine and travel show, and we called it Hollywood and Vines. And we traveled all over the world for the next, I don't know, 4 years, 5 years? And
7 years total.
It was 7 years total, yeah, I guess. It took a while. It took a long time to produce the, what did we do, 48 episodes, Terry? The concept of the show was about demystifying wine for people. Because we wanted people to understand that, you know, at the end of the day, wine didn't have to be this, super intimidating thing for people. At the end of the day, you know, people who grow wine are farmers. And the people who make wine are for the most part are people just like you and me, and they put their pants on one leg at a time, and they're really much more about the quality of the fruit that grows in the field, and they're people that are, you know, that they get their hands dirty and that want their wine to be the expression of what grows in the field, and that, you know, and the year that passed and the dirt that the fruit is grown in, and you know, we wanted that kind of knowledge to be passed down to people, so they weren't when a wine list got dropped in front of them on a table, it didn't have to be this super you know intense experience, and it wasn't so intimidating. And when a sommelier came over to them to talk to them, we would go talk to sommeliers and say, like, how should people talk to you, and what kind of information are you looking for from people, and how does someone who knows nothing about wine navigate a 400-page wine list? Like, how do you do this? So anyway, that was the concept of the show. And we tried to introduce people to new and interesting wine regions.
The very first person that he said, I said, where are we going? Where are we going to start? He said, we're going to Walla Walla. Why? Because Charles Smith is there. Let's go to Charles Smith and bug him. Let's kick some tires around Charles Smith. So we went to Walla Walla. And those people in Walla Walla said to us collectively, thank you for the dirt. Because there'd been a glacial dam halfway down the Okanagan Valley when it burst millions of years ago. All of that soil ended up in Walla Walla, and they're growing in it. And they actually went out of their way to say, thank you for this soil. This is fantastic soil. But we ended up, actually, when we finished with Charles Smith, we had a great time. He took us to the Worm Ranch, which was a fishing bait store. And we had incredible wines. On styrofoam cups and plastic plates and really good tacos and burritos and things. And I thought, this is heaven.
I can tell you the wine business has a dark side as well, Terry. It's not all worms and alcohol and dirt. There are other things. So Jason, you've been into wine for a long time. When was it that you sort of got bit by this? Was there a particular wine? Did you have it while you were filming? What was the thing that got you into it?
I try not to drink when I'm working.
I was
fortunate enough to be living in Los Angeles back in the late 80s and the early 90s through all of those unbelievable vintages, and I was on a big hit TV show back then. And I would, on my weekends off, I would drive up to the Napa Valley. And so I got exposed to all of these unbelievable big reds and beautiful crisp whites up there in the Napa Valley and, you know, in the early 90s. And I had the great fortune of, because I was pretty high profile back then, I had the great fortune of, I was in Camus one day and Chuck Wagner happened to be walking through the tasting room. And I guess his daughter was a big fan of my show. And he pulled me out of the tasting room and took me back into the aging cave. And I went barrel tasting with Chuck Wagner in the Camus aging caves. And he taught me about, what kind of barrels they used and the difference between toasted heads and not toasted heads and a heavy toast and a light toast and a medium toast. And, I sort of got backstage access to a lot of things that as a very young man. I mean, I was barely 21, 22 years old, and I got access to a lot of things in the wine industry that a lot of people my age didn't get access to, and that really opened my eyes and opened my palate and my taste buds to things that made me a lifelong fan of wine, and it's never let go of me.
Jason, as you continued on your learning journey through wine, and since Napa was kind of your first opening into the industry, did you later taste old world wines like from France and Italy and be like, oh, that reminds me of this wine from Napa, as opposed to most people who go through wine start in Europe and old world, and as they taste new worlds, their references go back to the old world. So yours was kind of the opposite.
Yeah, I did. I sort of engineered it backwards. But then I made a great contact at Butterfield & Butterfield, again, sort of in the mid 90s, and he gave me a great education into old world wine. He ran the wine department at Butterfield & Butterfield, and so I started buying a lot of wine through him. And he was a great educator for me and taught me about, you know, the difference between first and second and third and fourth and fifth growth French Bordeaux, and taught me about Italian wines and taught me about Spanish wines. And he was a great educator. And so I've been very lucky to have great teachers throughout my wine drinking life.
And what did he do with all that knowledge? When he had time between shoots, he would go to wine sales, estate sales, and he would sit in the audience and he'd buy cases of wine that he would store away and not see. He would leave in New York and he'd be living in Los Angeles, but he had those wines. And so he told me stories about what he was buying, like whole cases of stuff I had never heard about. But all of a sudden, I decided to do some digging around. He was my educator.
Oh, that's great. So are you? So we can call it the show. I mean, you were on 90210, and I do have to say this. I don't know if all the women in my life could just smell that I was going to interview you, Jason, but everybody came out of the woodwork, and they were like, Holy, I mean, you know, I've interviewed some of the biggest players in the NBA, all sorts of stuff, and nobody cares in my family. I go to interview Jason Priestley. It's almost like, I mean, you really, to say you were on a big show is an understatement of the century. Are you saying that you guys were not drinking on that set? You guys weren't sharing wine?
You weren't
out partying or anything? Really?
No, never. No.
Man, that's surprising.
No.
I would think at that age, because you're in the age where it's like you have the energy to go out and still show up for work and do all that stuff. You guys weren't going out after?
Oh, after work, 100%. Never at work.
Right.
No.
What were you guys drinking when you were filming that? Was there wine involved in filming 90210 or no?
For me, it always depended on what I was eating. You know, wine, food and wine is the pairing of food and wine is something that I always take very seriously. And it's one of my great passions, because I also am very passionate about food and what I'm cooking. And so the pairing of food and wine is always very important to me.
Even at that age, even when you were 22 years old, you were still had that mindset?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Just I understand being Canadian, it makes a lot of sense, but you now living in the States, why did you and Terry decide to make wine up in the Okanagan? Talk to me a little bit about that region. I think it's, first of all, I'll just really quickly say, I think it's one of the most beautiful wine regions in the world, but most Americans do not know much about it. So why did you choose the Okanagan, or did it sort of choose you, Terry?
First of all, just so you know, the Okanagan Valley is the northern tip, the very northern tip of the Sonora Desert. It's a desert. And you think, a lot of people think it stops at the border or just doesn't get that far. It's a desert. The diurnal shift is as much as 30 degrees between the day and the cold at night. It's fantastic. Gives us fresh wines. But the deal is, we were shooting in the Okanagan. We had shot outside of Ensenada in the Guadalupe Valley, and we'd gone to the other coast. But we decided to do three or four shows in and around the Okanagan. And watching on the Travel Channel out of the UK and London, in Croatia and Slovakia, was Michael Mosny, who was making wines on a massive scale with a small boutique winery off to the side. And he and his wife, Martina, saw this and went, A, look what they're growing there, and B, there's no pollution. Look, it's beautiful. So they got on a plane, they came over, they drove up and down the valley, they went back to Slovakia, and they sold everything, and they changed their life. They came to the Okanagan Valley, they bought some vineyards, started making Winemaker's Cut. All of a sudden, we were seeing this Winemaker's Cut brand all over the shelves, and I finally saw him at a wine pour and said, where did you guys come from? He said, you don't know the story then, do you? No. We saw you, we came, we changed our lives, we're here because of you. And 2 years later, he said to me, and I passed it on to Jason, why don't we make a wine together? And the first thing Jay said was, well, what's he got? He says, he's got five barrels. He's got a Bordeaux blend in barrel. And we went, yes, yeah. So that's what happened.
So you guys, the idea started off really with red, right? You were like, we want to try to emulate kind of a Bordeaux style. Yep, Q&A, you're holding up the bottle. So why did you start there? I mean, that's a pretty ambitious place. You started because he had the wine in barrel, or because that's what you wanted to do?
He was very excited about that fruit that he had just put in barrel from a new vineyard that he had contracted with. And he had, you know, it was just all in barrel, and it was all separated. And it was something that we could work on a blend together and come up with a blend for that Bordeaux blend. Doing a Bordeaux style blend was something in the Okanagan was something that I was very familiar with. The Black Hills Estate, that I was part of the ownership group for 12 years, that one of our big flagship wine was a Bordeaux style blend that we were very successful with there. So it was a type of wine in that region that I was very familiar with making. So it was, for me, it just felt like a very natural fit for us to all do together as our first wine.
Love it. How do you stand out with a wine like this? Because I think it's not that it's a crowded market, it's just difficult to get the word out. And I'm sure you having a little bit of notoriety helps, and I'm sure Terry being very popular up in Vancouver. But still, how do you get the word out about this wine? Is it a challenge growing wine in Canada versus doing it in Napa or something like that? What are your challenges, and how do you get it out known?
It's the same challenges that you would have in Napa, Sonoma, wherever. Same challenges. You got to take care of your grapes and your process, the barrel program, all of that. But the cool thing was is that Michael brought with him those smarts. he knows where the sweet spot is. And we went through a blending process where we had a virtual taste off, and eventually I think it was bottle number two. But that was the bit, that was it. And we went with that. You got instinct, Jay.
We also had to push Michael sort of out of his comfort zone with the style of wine that he makes. You know, he makes wine in a very restrained, you know, Eastern European style where he sort of lets the fruit do the talking. And we wanted to make a wine that was bolder than he was used to making, and had more oak influence on it, had more bottom end than the other Bordeaux style blends that he had made under his other winemaker's cut label. I brought a lot of the knowledge that I had from our previous winery that I had gleaned from our winemaker, and, you know, things that I knew that worked well for us at Black Hills to help give our wine more bottom end, more grip, deeper tannins, because we didn't want our wine to just sort of be a carbon copy of anything else that he had done at Winemaker's Cut. We wanted it to stand out and be something individual, and hopefully something elevated from the other wines that he had made before.
I just wanted to speak a little bit about the Okanagan from a global perspective, because it's still a relatively new region. I mean, it's only been making wine commercially for a few decades, several decades possibly. Yep. And up in the northern part of the valley, where Pinot Noir and, you know, aromatic whites are specifically more popular, the red blend is being grown in the south where it gets the heat.
Yep.
So what about, I mean, when we're marketing this wine, hopefully to the States one day and maybe beyond, what about this wine speaks to what the Okanagan is about?
It's about that particular area. Because if you grow 10 kilometers away, if you grow 1,000 yards away, it's going to be a different wine. It's actually the craft of the blend. It's the growing. It's the farming. It's the sustainability. It's the organics. It's all of that. But it's the smarts of Jay to know when you hit that spot, when that sweet spot comes along, says that's it. That's your wine right there. And you only get that from tasting great wines. And also the fact is that the wine told us what it wanted to be. I mean, we just set it in motion. And actually, it's interesting. When your name's on the damn label, it's kind of it's a different ride. Not on the front, but on the back. Still, it's small, and it's a signature, but still, your name's on the bottle. You take great care before you send it off to the world. And it's going to find it will find its fans and will become a favorite.
What kind of impact does it have, Jason? I mean, just to ask bluntly, for you having such a well-known name, what kind of impact does that have on your brand awareness? Because I've spoken to a lot of, I really hate the term celebrities, you know, but like people who are, you come in with some cachet and it helps at one point, and then it's sort of like you want the wine to be able to speak for itself.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to what kind of advantage and maybe even disadvantage that is to have your name associated with the wine.
I feel like you're right. It can be an advantage. It can also be a disadvantage, because I feel like I feel like having my name associated with the wine can open a door, but the juice in the bottle has to deliver. Otherwise, that door is going to get slammed just as quickly as it would with nobody's name attached to the wine. You know, like if my daughter wanted to be in a movie, you know, the fact that her last name is Priestley might be able to get her an audition, but she still has to deliver in the audition or she's not going to get the part. I feel like the wine is, it may be nepotism wine, but it still has to deliver.
I was going to say, is this Nepo wine? What are we doing here?
I mean, you know, the juice in the bottle still has to be great juice. You know what I mean? I mean, it's got a great story to tell, and everybody loves to be able to go to a dinner party and, you know, and hey, man, this is Jason Priestley's wine. It's super cool, right? And put that bottle on the table and be able to tell a great story. But the juice that's in the bottle still has to be good juice. Otherwise, what's the point?
Oh, by the way, Jay's standards are extremely high. There's no fooling around. You either make the mark or you don't do it.
Well, I see the painting behind him. I can tell his standards are through the roof. There's absolutely no question this guy has an eye. So how much wine are you guys actually producing?
That vintage of Q&A, which was our 2020 vintage, we produced 670 cases.
670 cases. So you guys will be profitable in 2075, right?
That's right. Yep. Okay. You know, it's the old story. The best way to make a small amount of money in the wine business is to start with a large amount of money.
Yes. Don't get me started on starting a streaming service, but
we have a white coming.
Nice. And so what is your white? I mean, so obviously the Bordeaux blend speaks for itself. You know, it's a Cabernet Merlot, that kind of base. But what white did you guys go with?
Chardonnay, RMV, Roussanne, Marsanne, Viognier.
Look at that. So you guys went all Rhone blend on your white.
Yep.
Is there a reason for that? Why that and not something more name checked like Chardonnay or Sauv Blanc?
It was some newly contracted fruit that Michael had that he was super excited about. And he was really excited to try to make a wine with it. And he kicked us down a few samples of things that he was thinking about. And one of them was so outstanding that we were just like, oh, that's it right there. Don't touch it. Put it in a bottle. And it's unbelievably good. It's so crisp and just with a hint of that, you know, beautiful, you know, Vaseline, just
kind of floral
just a,
thing
just a
from
Soussan of, yep. And it's just gorgeous. And it's so drinkable with or without food. You know, it's just unbelievable. Yeah, it's really good.
The one thing you should know that is always talked about in Okanagan wines and Canadian wines, Ontario doesn't send to BC, BC doesn't send to Ontario, because Ontario believes that we're homers. We drink everything that we make here. And we do. Alberta comes along for the ride. We know that. But in terms of productivity south of the border, you got to have a lot more than the wines that we're making, but you're going to help. At least people will be able to get a hold of us and find out where the distributor is sending bottles stateside. Because Michael said that right at the very beginning. He said, we're going to send this to the States as well. So there you go.
That Q&A white, you know, we made 350 cases of it. Like our production on these wines, because we are, you know, we're a premium priced wine. Like, you know, their Q&A red is $50 a bottle, and the Q&A white is I think $42 a bottle. Like they're high end wines for our market, and they sell very quickly, and people, you know, the response to them has been fantastic so far, which is really nice. But one of the reasons that British Columbia wines get consumed mostly in British Columbia is that the acreage that is under vine in British Columbia, and that the amount of acreage that can be under vine in British Columbia, just isn't that much. Like there's not an endless supply of acreage that is actually within the northern tip of the Sonora Desert. What is available is all pretty much under vine now. So the amount of wine that can be produced from that acreage is not that great. And there are a lot of thirsty people apparently in Canada. As Nicole can attest to, Canadians like to drink because the winters are cold and they're long.
There's still snow on the ground here, to be honest, in Calgary.
So if you're in Canada, where can you get the wine? I mean, I know in the States it's coming.
QA.wine.
QA.wine. Okay, very good. .wine. I like that. I guess my last question has to do with so your winemaker, he is from Eastern Europe, right? He is Croatian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you guys must, I can't imagine you don't ever butt heads. I mean, I know several Croatians and I can tell you they're not exactly the most passive group of people I've ever met in my life.
No, he's a great guy. Right, Jay?
Yeah, he's super cool, super level-headed. The one thing that he draws a line in the sand on is using Eastern European oak in his oak regimen, always.
Slovenian, I mean, is that? Yeah,
Slovenian oak. That's what he likes to use. So we use a combination of French and Slovenian oak in our aging regimen.
Yeah, that's great. No, that's a unique thing. You don't see that a lot, I'm sure, up there.
Yeah, it's kind of cool, actually. I kind of like what it does to the wine.
As I mentioned off air before we started this, today is we're recording this on my birthday, and I have to do this because one of my absolute favorite films is Tombstone. And
yep.
I know you were in Beverly Hills 90210 and several other films, Calendar Girls and all this stuff. But for me, Jason, my money and most of my tattoos are about the film Tombstone. So I have to do 2 minutes with you just to ask you some questions about what that set was like. Cause it's obviously I could do like 40 hours of podcasting on that film. And I want to ask you because Kurt Russell's a winemaker as well. And I'm wondering if the two of you guys have ever drank wine together, because listening to him talk about wine is absolutely both hysterical and very enlightening. Have you ever drank wine with Kurt?
I have. Not a lot. only once in Vancouver, actually, at a friend's house. And he was living, it was when he was living up, because his son Wyatt was playing junior hockey up there. And Kurt and I sat and had a couple glasses of wine. And we were talking about wine. And we were talking about, it was right when he was starting to make wine. And we talked about wine, and he's doing very well with his winemaking now, which is really cool. And he's, Kurt, you know, Kurt's an awesome guy. I don't get to see him very often because, you know, he lives in Colorado most of the time nowadays. And so I don't get to see him very often, but whenever I do see him, we definitely have a good laugh, and it's always nice to catch up with him whenever I do see him.
All right. So this is my $1 million question. Who actually directed that film? Who was the real director of Tombstone? I know there was a replacement, and then George Cosmatos came in. But the rumor is Kurt Russell effectively directed this film, and I need this dispelled for me.
You need it confirmed.
Yeah, I want to know. I mean, you were on set, and I know that the set was tumultuous, to say the least. Produced a great film, but
yeah.
who directed Tombstone? George has passed away. You can tell the truth.
Yeah, Kurt really directed the film. He was really the driving force behind that film, and he was really directing that film.
See, this is what you get to do on your birthday.
That's your birthday,
Cole.
Present, Jason.
Yep. That's it.
Yeah.
I mean,
you got your answer. Yeah.
If there were three or four sets in the history of filmmaking that I could have been on, I would probably put Tombstone in that list of movie sets I would have wanted to be on, chaos and all. So
it was pretty cool. Like we had. I mean, as tumultuous as it was and how difficult it was at times, there were also a lot of times when we were all just having a really good time, you know, like, yeah, you know, how many days, you know, were we sitting around the old Tucson studios, and me and Powers Booth and Sam Elliott and Bill Paxton, and we were all sitting around, you know, playing cards and drinking whiskey and waiting for them to set up a shot. You know, it was super, super fun.
Was it real whiskey you guys were drinking on set, or was it
something? I was going to say, you drank there.
I can neither confirm nor deny those allegations at this time. There may have been some real whiskey drank on that set.
Anytime you mix whiskey and Billy Zane, I think that you've got a winning combination.
Billy was hardly there. Billy, you know, Billy got shot right away. He was hardly there. But
this is the best.
There may have been some whiskey consumed on that set.
This is great. Well, it's truly an honor talking to you guys. You know, I just want to thank you for your time. And I want everybody in Canada to get out there and get Q&A wine.
QA.wine.
Fantastic stuff. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time.
Happy birthday.
Hey, thank you
yeah,
so
happy
much.
Happy birthday, Joe Jason.
Yep, I am... I'm going to go watch Tombstone and drink some wine right now. I want to thank everybody for listening. I hope now that people think of Jason Priestley as Jason Priestley of the SOM TV podcast, because that is his greatest accomplishment to this point. I want everybody to remember, go to SOMTV.com and subscribe and enjoy all of our great content. I want to thank Nicole McKay for joining us. Everybody, please be safe, and if you have the chance, get out there and get a bottle of Canadian wine, especially from the Okanagan. It is delicious stuff. All right, talk soon.